Hello and welcome to History for Weirdos.
We're your hosts, Andrew
and Stephanie.
And each week, we're going to take you on a journey into the strange, obscure, and relentlessly entertaining corners of human history.
Now listen up, friends, because it's about to get weird.
Happy New Year, Weirdos!
Welcome to episode number 114 of History for Weirdos.
The first episode of 2024.
Yes, and if you're watching this and not listening to it, mm-hmm. or doing both preferably, mm-hmm. you'll notice that we are in a kitchen, or what looks like a kitchen, and that is because we're in a hotel room. Yes. We're actually recording this on New Year's Eve,
mm-hmm.
for the new year.
Yep. In between get-togethers with friends,
yes.
we are sitting in this hotel room to bring you all the very first episode of the year.
Yes, I've already had a couple of drinks, so this should be a really interesting episode. Thankfully, though, it is not my week.
Yes.
Thankfully. I'm sure many of you would prefer it maybe just because of my state, but...
That's a good point.
Yes.
It is my week, and I don't drink, so this is appropriate.
Thank God.
Yeah. It's your week.
So, Stephanie, without further ado, what do you have for us in the new year?
Today, we are going to be talking about Queen Victoria and her killer wet nurse.
Killer? Like, she was a great wet nurse?
No, unfortunately, killer in the traditional sense.
Oh, wow. So, but not traditional killer wet nurse. I don't think that's a tradition, right?
It's not a tradition, no.
Okay.
For good reason. For and good we will see why. So it's going to be an interesting episode for sure. This is weird in the not so great way.
Ooh.
And I promise, even though it's a wet nurse that commits murder, it's not too gruesome. I skip the gory details. You'll learn the whole story, but you don't need to hear the icky stuff if you don't like that.
Okay, and that's probably for the best.
This is probably for the best.
We're starting the new year on a bright note, aren't we?
I was like, you know what? Let's start things off positive and hopeful. I picked this topic for some reason.
Yes, I'm so happy.
Well, before I tell you about this wet nurse, this very infamous wet nurse, I'm going to talk to you all a little bit about Queen Victoria and the Victorian era.
Nice.
So, Victoria was born at Kensington Palace. I'm sure you've heard of it.
I know Kensington Palace.
In London on May 24th, 1819.
Yeah.
She was the only daughter of Edward, the Duke of Kent, and he was the fourth son of George III.
Wow. So, he was the fourth son.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that means he was not expecting to be the monarch then.
Yeah. Victoria's father died shortly after her birth, actually. And she became heir to the throne because her three uncles who preceded her in the line of succession had no surviving legitimate children.
Okay, this is so weird.
Yeah. She was the only surviving heir.
Wow.
So it skipped a bunch of people and went to her.
Wow. So, okay. So a bunch of people in her family didn't have kids, and then she made up for all of them, I believe, right?
Yep.
She had like a million children.
Yeah, exactly. We're going to be getting into that actually in a little bit.
And guys, when I say a million, I mean not literally a million, just to be perfectly clear.
We were all really concerned.
Okay.
So Queen Victoria is often remembered as one of the longest reigning monarchs in British history, as she was queen of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland from June 20th, 1837, until she died in 1901.
Wow. It's a long time.
Her reign was 63 years and 216 days.
Jeez.
Very long reign, longer than any of her predecessors.
Right, and only Elizabeth II lasted longer, right?
Mm-hmm. I actually touch on that in a little bit too.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm just spoiler after spoilers here.
You're reading my mind pretty
oh my
much. Oh my gosh. Yeah. And of course, as we know, her reign is known as the Victorian era.
It's the Victorian era.
Named after her. And the fun fact that I have here is that Queen Elizabeth II was Victoria's great, great-granddaughter. And in 2015 is when she totally outdid Victoria as the longest reigning British monarch in history. And then here's where the tea gets hot. When I was looking this up, Prince Philip, her husband, was also Queen Victoria's great-great-grandchild.
Oh.
They were third cousins.
I mean.
And then they were also second cousins once removed via another family member.
Oh, wow. So they got the double whammy going.
They got double cousins, basically.
I mean, I know, like, legally, like, that's fine. It's just kind of weird.
Their whole what's weird to me is when, you know, I was looking this up, their whole family tree, if you look up, like, illustrations of it, it's like a maze.
Like, oh, boy.
Things are connecting that maybe shouldn't connect so often.
Oh, my God.
So that's just a little fun fact on the side. All right. So we're back in the Victorian era. This was like the time for industrial hustle, mm-hmm. economic boom, and scientific progress. We're thinking big names like Charles Dickens and Charles Darwin. They're doing their thing.
So the Charleses are on point.
Yeah, the Charleses are on point in the Victorian era. And on the outside, I think it really looked just like an empire that was prospering. But hey, it's not all sunshine and rainbows. There's also Jack the Ripper doing his horror show.
Ooh, doing fun.
His thing, I guess.
Hey, he's just doing his thing.
He's just doing his thing.
Is it like eviscerating people, like innocent people? Yes. But, you know, he's doing his thing.
And, of course, there were also the really grim horrors and truths of the Crimean War at this time.
Oh, I always forget about that war.
Yeah. Overall, the era is in and of itself a bit of a wild ride with a lot of contradictions, which I know we've touched on before on mm-hmm. this podcast. But I just kind of wanted to set the scene for the world that we're in for this story. And just really cool. I always loved this saying for some reason. At Queen Victoria's death, it was said that Britain had a worldwide empire on which the sun never set.
Yes, and we hear that like constantly.
Yeah, that's so interesting. So in addition to her regal achievements, Andrew, what you were getting at, Queen Victoria was also known for having babies.
She had a lot of children.
A lot of babies. Queen Victoria and her husband, Prince Albert, were very famously known as a love match, which was not common. You know, it's not common with royal families. Typically, marriages are out of convenience, not out of romance.
Right, out of like a sense of duty and like, oh, this is a good political match.
Yeah, political match is a better way of putting it. It's strategic.
It's strategic, yes.
Mm-hmm. But these two loved each other and their love made a lot of kids. They had, let me see here, 9 children.
Okay, 9. That's, I mean, still less than your Abwe.
Abwe technically gave birth to 10. Yes, that's true. But she raised 9. And they had 5 girls and 4 boys with 17 years in between the oldest and the youngest.
Wow. So they were just busy.
They were busy. Apparently people who attended to them were like, yeah, they were busy. Okay. We all heard it.
No, like for real, right?
Yeah. Yeah. They were known for, you know, what the thing you not got to do to make babies. So let me tell you who their kids were really quickly. There was Princess Victoria, AKA Vicky, who was said to be her dad's favorite, Prince Albert's favorite. There was Albert Edward, Prince of Wales, AKA Birdie. So cute.
That's his nickname, Birdie.
Birdie, like Bert and Ernie.
Oh, got it. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Then there was Princess Alice, Prince Alfred, Duke of Edinburgh, Princess Helena, Princess Louise, Prince Arthur, Duke of Connaught. He was said to be Queen Victoria's favorite.
Ooh.
Prince Leopold and Princess Beatrice. Whew.
Oh my God, that was a lot.
There's a lot of them.
I already forgot them, to be honest with you. There was too many.
So many kids and so many titles and locations associated with their names.
Let me ask you a question. Mm-hmm. When you have that many kids, do you think you might like forget one like here and there, like every once in a while?
So that's so funny because there's this thing that my abuela is famous for, who raised 9 kids, as we just said, is she'll be trying to speak to one of her children. Like, say she's trying to talk to my mom, whose name is Ada. She'll go, Evelia, Leticia, Margarita, Mirna. Like, she just starts naming them all until she gets the right one.
She just goes through a full cycle.
She just goes through all of them. And then finally, Ada.
I'm sure she loves that.
My mom?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's her favorite. My mom's the youngest of 9.
Yeah. So she gets the gambit, the full gambit.
Yes. So I bet every once in a while you forget some stuff that's going on. You've got to forget a birthday.
There's too many.
You forget their middle name, something like that, right? Like, there's so many kids to keep track of. And actually, we're going to get into a little bit of her child rearing here. So she was pretty involved in taking care of Vicky, the eldest, mm-hmm. which makes sense. It's the firstborn. And then a little bit less so with Birdie. That's the future king, actually, Albert. And then as her family just kept growing, and of course your responsibilities as a monarch don't let up, she spent less time directly overseeing the care of her kids. Later in life, she admitted to Vicky, her eldest daughter, in letters that she would only check in on them directly probably once every 3 months.
Oh my God, that's terrible.
Like one-on-one time, once every 3 months.
So she might have been like a good monarch, maybe not the best mother though.
I really wonder, and we just have always had such different expectations of mothers and fathers, right? Because I don't think most kings, Western kings that we think of, were good fathers.
Terrible. I mean, Henry VIII was awful. I mean, I'm sure.
We already know that.
But I mean, like, he had no redeeming qualities, even as a father.
But think a really good example would actually be not a king, but Marcus Aurelius.
Oh, he was not a good father.
Really wise, philosophical, a great leader, but obviously not a great dad.
I'm really honored and amazed that you brought up like ancient Rome. I'm very proud of you.
Did that just for you, babe.
Thank you. Thank you. Yes, but that's a really, like, all jokes aside, that's actually a really good example.
Mm-hmm. I just wonder if it's even possible to run an empire and be a good parent at the same time.
You know what? If you ever do that, you should write a book about it.
If any weirdos listening have run an empire while raising children, you let us know.
Yeah, I'm genuinely curious.
So, since Queen Victoria was so busy having a million kids, like you said, and overseeing an empire, she used a wet nurse for all of her children, which was totally normal among royals. In Western Europe, wealthy and noble families would often employ wet nurses because breastfeeding actually requires a lot of time. It's like a full-time job. And you have to, when you're not breastfeeding, you're like constantly eating and drinking water because it takes so much energy from you. And obviously Queen Victoria couldn't do that. And if a woman isn't breastfeeding, she'll get her menstruation back. She'll get her period back and she's fertile again. So in noble families and royal families, you can imagine why that's so important, right? You need to get back to making heirs as soon as possible.
And they did. And Victoria and Albert, they really did.
They really did. But for those that may be wondering what exactly is a wet nurse.
Thank you. Yeah.
A wet nurse is a lactating woman who breastfeeds. So that's going to be a mom who had a baby probably around the same time as you. And she's breastfeeding her baby, but also breastfeeding your baby.
Wow.
As a job. So Queen Victoria's wet nurse for Prince Albert, Bertie, mm-hmm. was a woman by the name of Marianne Burrow, and she was born roughly in 1811. She would have come from pretty humble means, working class woman, and it looks like she likely got the job as wet nurse because her husband George also worked for the royal family. He worked on the grounds. He had assumed or inherited a position of his father's, and so he kind of got her foot in the door that way. And she would have nursed Prince Albert, I think, for about 8 to 10 months.
Oh, wow.
Until and I think it would have been typical to nurse for about a year. And then one day she was randomly let go. And no one knew why. Like, no one from the outside, right? I'm sure Queen Victoria and her husband knew, but she was just let go randomly. And after that, she settles down in a cottage in what is known as West Esher. That's the region, with her husband, George. Okay. And then after she's let go, she has her second daughter. So she was wet nursing because she'd had her first child. Then she has her second daughter, who was born in 1843. So that's around the time that we're at here. And then very shortly after, she has five more children, one right after another.
Wow. Okay. So she's following in Victoria's steps, it seems like.
She was inspired by the queen there.
Yeah.
And I wrote in my notes as I was researching this, oh my God, I'm tired just thinking about that.
I know. I can imagine.
That's a lot of kids. So she she had seven kids total, Mary Ann Burrell. Okay.
Wow.
So now we're going to get to the more horrific part of this story.
Lovely. Let's go.
So let's set the scene. It's a Saturday morning on June 10th, 1854, and two men, one named Meagher and one named Peasley, these are their surnames,
yes,
are strolling past the residence. I'm sorry, I think I said her last name was Burrow, but I think it's Bruh is how you would pronounce it.
Gotcha. Okay. Bruh.
So they're strolling past Mary Ann's home in Esher, and suddenly they spot a bloody pillow just chilling in the window of someone's home.
Uh-oh.
Talk about a red flag.
Literally.
Just see like a bloody pillow. Thankfully, they don't ignore this like very strange situation, and they rally some other neighbors to investigate. So they get into the house, and it turns out that Mary Ann, who is about 43 at this time, is in the house with a nasty throat wound and she cannot talk. But sadly, that's not all. Six of her kids also have slashes in their throats.
Oh my God.
All the kids who are injured are deceased and Mary Ann is clinging to life. She's bleeding to death. So the folks on the scene quickly get her to a doctor, and everyone's wondering, like, who would do this to a mother and her children, who would just slit their throats like that? But the doctor miraculously almost is able to kind of like sew her up, and she's able to still use her vocal cords. And as soon as she can speak, she confesses to murdering her children and saying that she also attempted to kill herself.
Oh my God.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Yeah. That's the big, big question that everyone was wondering.
Yeah.
I'll just really briefly name the kids here. The children were Georgiana, her second daughter, who was 11, William, age 8, Carrie, age 7, Harriet and Henry, who were 4-year-old twins, and little George, who was somewhere between 1 and 2 years old. The different sources said different ages,
mm-hmm,
but somewhere between 1 and 2. So she had a 1-year-old to an 11-year-old deceased at this point. So, as mentioned, she confessed to the murders, but the cops and everyone else were confused, so they were digging into things a bit more. And they started connecting the dots, seeing that Mary Ann's world was unraveling a bit before this tragedy.
Okay.
So on June 6th, which would have been 4 days before she did the unthinkable, her husband, George, walked out on them.
Okay. I was just about to ask, where is this, her husband, during mm-hmm all of this?
Apparently, George had suspicions that Mary was stepping out on him.
Oh, snap.
And guess what?
He
had receipts.
Oh!
He hired a private investigator to follow her around, and he reported back that on May 29th, so a few days before, people spotted Mary leaving a London tavern with some mystery man, and they ended up at what can only be described as a, quote, questionable house.
Questionable.
Mm-hmm. I think in the Victorian era, a woman walking into a home alone with a man who is not her husband was enough of a sign that she was cheating, apparently, because that's literally the only evidence that the private investigator gets. And the next day that George receives this information, he loses it on Marianne. He leaves her and he says that he is going to fight to get custody and take all of their kids away from her.
Oh, snap.
So that's not looking good.
No, that's not looking good at all.
And then something else to consider here, something that's uncovered during the investigation, is that right after George leaves and makes the threat about the kids, all the kids catch measles. They get sick.
Okay.
It's a pretty common disease at that time. It's really terrible. And at this time, it could definitely prove fatal to have measles. And according to Mary's later reports to the police, she was caring for the kids all alone. She didn't have anyone helping her.
Mm-hmm.
They were up all night crying. Everyone's sick and feverish. And Mary had not slept in days.
Oh, so you think this could have just been a psychotic break?
It's possible. I want to hear what you think for sure when I'm done. She was stricken with really severe headaches, and she remembers beginning to contemplate death by suicide. She was later quoted saying, "There was something like a cloud over my eyes. I thought I would go down, get a knife, and cut my throat." Then there are descriptions of the scene and kind of like what happened, what she did to her kids, but I just wanted to leave that out because no one wants those images in their heads. If you want to look it up, it's easy to find. But a little while after this sort of cloud was over her head, she wakes up and she sees her children drenched in blood, and she tries to yell for help, but she cannot because she has cut her own throat. And she realizes in that moment what she has done.
Oh, my God. So she, it's not like she's like one of those crazy people that's like, oh, no, I did it. Like the voices told me to do it and everything. It seemed like she immediately regrets it. Or like, oh, my like Lord Savior Satan told me like is like totally cool with this.
Yeah. Or even when you hear terrible cases even today about people who harm their children, their family, trying to justify like it was better for them for us to be together.
Right.
She doesn't say anything like that. It seems when, you know, she describes, she has memory of what she did to her kids, but it almost sounds like she's in a fugue state.
Yes, I was just about to say that.
Like it sounds like she's like watching herself kind of do that and then passes out after cutting her throat and then wakes up and is horrified.
Yeah, rightfully so.
So horrified that I know this is kind of a dark thought, you guys, but I feel like in this time period, you really could get away with murder because they have such little forensics.
Right. She could. I mean, her own throat was slit, so she could have just said like, oh,
it was an attacker.
Exactly. She could have gotten away with it easily, I feel like.
But she confesses immediately. She feels so terrible.
Yeah.
So I think that's something to consider, right? So when she realizes that she cannot scream for help, the first thing she thinks of is to grab one of the bloody pillows and put it in the window, hoping that it attracts attention.
And it does.
And it does. I also want to note that during the investigation, and I mean, you could take this with a grain of salt, but Marianne's neighbors described her as a really good mother.
Oh.
For example, one of her neighbors named Sarah Weller said that Mary was, quote, very kind to her children, almost too kind.
Oh.
Ironic.
Very ironic.
And then one of the men who discovered her was a neighbor as well. And he said, quote, she always appeared to be very good and very kind to her children. And even the local constable was familiar with her. And he said, quote, I considered her as good a mother as ever lived.
Mm.
So again, you could take that with a grain of salt, we never really know our neighbors, but the people in her community were very, very shocked. Like, no one would have expected this. So then we're going to fast forward a little bit. We're going from June to August. It's August 8th, and Mary has recovered from her injuries, and she's standing trial for the murder of her children. The defense's argument here is insanity.
It's a good defense, honestly.
They called an expert alienist, which was a psychiatrist. That's what they called them.
An alienist.
An alienist.
That's amazing.
I know. That sounds like a cooler job. Like, yeah. You study the psychiatry or the psychology of aliens.
Hell yeah.
That would be really cool. I would want that job. Is that just me?
No, that sounds pretty legit.
Yeah, that's so cool.
That'd definitely be you, though.
But anyway, he has nothing to do with aliens. It's just like a mental health expert at the time. His name was Forbes B. Winslow.
Forbes B. Winslow here.
Forbes B. Winslow. And he testified on Marianne's behalf. But his argument's kind of like, to me, kind of dumb. He said his main argument is that Marianne must have been insane because women's maternal instinct would make it impossible for a not insane mother to kill her offspring.
Okay. Yes, that's dumb, but only in modern context. I feel like people back then would be like, yes, that absolutely makes sense. Like, I could see that.
Yeah. I wish that were true.
Oh, no.
No, I just mean, unfortunately, people do harm their children.
Yeah.
I wish that were like facts. It's just kind of like, him being like, she's a woman. Of course not.
Yeah. Oh, hey, she's a woman.
I don't know why we're talking with the transatlantic accent when they're Victorian age British people, but it sounds old timey. So
yeah, it's basically the farthest old timey voice we have.
Yes. However, I will say that I think there is a good argument here for insanity. She was sleep deprived. She was really stressed, like, not just be like, her kids are sick with something that could kill them already. Not like sick now, when I'm sure parents listening know this. Anytime your kid gets sick, you're just like really stressed because they're in pain and they're suffering. But this is like actually very scary. And then something that I thought about, which they would not have really considered back then, is if her youngest child, George, I believe, was one. Mm-hmm. She would still be in the time frame of being susceptible to postpartum psychosis, which can be triggered by extreme stress and sleep deprivation.
Very interesting.
So it's possible she did have kind of like a psychotic break there, and was not seeing things clearly. I think that's very possible. But at the end of the day, it was just her and her kids, so we don't know.
Right. And maybe this mystery man.
Oh, my gosh. You're just throwing that in there. Stirring the pot.
Stirring the pot, baby.
You think, like, the mystery man was trying to get rid of her and her kids?
Exactly.
Wow.
Because it was all a psyop.
That's interesting, because they did bring up her freaking husband testified against her. That obviously, since he's basically like, obviously, since she was cheating on me, she's a bad person.
So, of course, she would kill her kids.
But he didn't say anything about, like, as a mom, she was really harsh, or she hated the kids, or she made threats. He was like, she cheated on me, of all people.
So he was just really hurt and lashing out.
Yeah, really, really hurt. So they were, the other side was trying to really paint this picture of some immoral woman who is trying to get rid of her kids and run off with another guy, but her attempting to harm herself doesn't really line up with that.
No, that's, and it wasn't just like a superficial wound either. It sounded like, I mean, she cut her vocal cords, or at least hurt them.
Yeah, that sounds really bad.
It's rough.
So although, as I mentioned, Mary Ann confessed multiple times, she just kept being like, yeah, that was me.
Yeah, I did it.
And it was terrible, and I feel terrible, and I don't know what to do. Even though she did that. And then the judge openly advised the jury to find her guilty.
Okay, I feel like that doesn't really, you don't really do that in
court.
What
is the point of a jury then if you're going to do stuff like that?
Yeah.
The jury still returned with the verdict of not guilty.
Oh, by reason of insanity?
By reason of insanity.
Nice.
Yeah, so they seem to believe that argument as well. So, unsurprisingly, the news of this was, like, sensational, like, spread really fast, particularly because her association with the royal family.
That makes sense.
And what is so silly to think about, but was definitely a belief at this time, was that wet nurses needed to be very virtuous women, because it was believed that they could pass on traits to the baby that they were feeding. Right? Like, oh, like he'll pick up some of my personality because I'm feeding him. It is a very intimate thing to do, but that I don't think that's a thing. And so, of course, people were having a field day that this woman who murdered her children did probably the most unforgivable thing you can do, breastfed the future king.
Right. And so people were losing it. It's funny, people have thought this for thousands of years. I know, like, in ancient Spartan society,
they thought that as well.
Yeah, especially, well, a little, and even a little interesting twist is that they would want, like, the men and women, when they're, you know, coupling and procreating, to be happy.
Yes.
So not only, like, healthy and physically fit, and which, like, and science kind of, like, actually validates that today, but, like, actually, like, being happy.
Because that would pass on to the baby.
Exactly.
That's really funny because I think I've told you this. In Mexico, a lot of people, like if you see a cute baby or something, like a really particularly beautiful baby, you'll be like, wow, you two must have made that baby with a lot of love.
You're like,
like it's a sign. It's seen as a sign that the couple was very in love.
That's kind of cute.
Yeah. So there is this interesting belief here about things getting passed down that probably isn't true, right?
Yeah, probably not, but
because of this, of course, everyone was like freaking out, like, what is this gonna do to the like little birdie, and this is wild. She was in the royal family's home and she was a murderer.
Oh my gosh, birdie, what is gonna happen to you, buddy?
I know. And then of course the news does reach obviously Queen Victoria. It made her think of her son.
Right.
And Queen Victoria recorded in her diary regarding this case, quote, "A most awful and horrid tragedy has taken place at Esher. Mrs. Brough, for 8 months, Bertie's wet nurse, has murdered her 6 children. The news quite haunts one. She was, it seems, a most depraved woman. Morose, ill-tempered, and stupid, she always used to be when in our house," end quote. So I think we know why she got fired.
Oh, so she was dumb.
She was dumb. Apparently she was morose, ill-tempered, and stupid. That's not a great combination.
So, okay, that's, I guess, mystery solved.
Mystery solved as to why she lost her employment.
Yeah.
And even though Marianne was found not guilty, that doesn't mean she was free to go. She was sentenced to life in a mental institution known as Bedlam. Staff there noted that she was quiet, kind of kept to herself, and was nonviolent. That's what we know of her time there. She dies in Bedlam just 8 years later after a series of strokes.
I wonder if she just was just too sad to keep on going on.
I can't imagine, you know, if she did not want to harm her children, if we are to believe that premise, and she experienced some sort of psychosis or like fever or something. I can't imagine the trauma of that, of waking up and realizing that you've done that
every single day. I feel like you would just,
it would do so much to your brain.
Yeah,
I think the strokes make sense somehow. That's my like pseudoscience. I'm like, yes, the two things are connected.
Yeah, I mean, maybe just the mental trauma, like it has to take a toll.
How could it not?
Right.
And then being in a mental hospital in the Victorian era is probably not the chillest vibe.
I was just going to say, it's not going to be a good time.
I don't think so.
A good time was had by none in that place.
I agree. Unfortunately, I guess, she becomes really famous, though, while she's in there. She does do a few more interviews. That's how we have more snippets about like what was going on in the house. Again, didn't include that, but you can look it up. She becomes so famous that the house where she murdered her kids became like a tourist attraction.
Oh, of course it did. People love the like the macabre.
I agree. Especially in the Victorian era where they're yes. also so externally focused on propriety and looking civilized and being civilized. They're also so fascinated by this like icky underbelly of humanity.
Yeah, that is really interesting. It's like a juxtaposition of like things that shouldn't go together, but they do. Yeah, yes. Like especially like British and even American society at the time were very like prim and proper.
Mm-hmm.
But there was like an obsession with like the occult, with like kind of the weird stuff. And then as well as, you know, obviously with like science, which is a little bit more mainstream, but these like, especially like the occult and like kind of being like uptight.
Yeah.
They do not go together.
You would think not, but this actually, what you just said reminds me of a previous episode that I did on the spiritualist.
Yes. The spiritualism was huge, right?
Huge during this time where you know, you think of like, a proper Christian society wouldn't necessarily be trying to talk with ghosts or in spirits, but people at this time loved that as well.
Right.
But I will say, I think the fascination with true crime, particularly such a gruesome, unthinkable crime, to me is still a little surprising that these people were like, yeah, let's go see where she murdered her kids.
Right. You just wouldn't think of that of people in like the 19th century.
I wouldn't want to do that today. Not for a crime like that.
No, that's brutal. That's particularly vicious.
That's awful to think about. But yeah, people were like hopping in there. I don't know.
This is dope.
Yeah, with popcorn and a little gift shop for all we know. Having a good time.
Unreal.
This case also inspired a poem called the Escher Tragedy. Because again, that's the area that it took place in. It's a super depressing poem. So I did not include it in this episode.
I'm glad.
But you can Google the Escher Tragedy poem if you want to. This was so big. It's wild to me that we don't hear more about it. Like, people could not stop talking about this. This was all over the paper. There were really unsettling like cartoons about it. It became very famous. And I've never heard of like, I don't know, you'd think there'd be like a TV drama or a movie or a book or something about this case.
I mean, I had never heard of this until just now, basically. So, and that is surprising because it is such a particularly vicious case.
Yes. And it was so impactful, I think, to the like community that even 2 decades after this crime, so Mary Ann is dead. Like, it's been 2 decades. In London, a wax museum recreated the gruesome scene of the murders.
My God.
In the scene, there's Mary Ann standing over her 6 dead children in a bloody nightdress, wearing a label on her that says, quote, "This woman has nursed His Royal Highness, the Prince of Wales," end quote. Not very tasteful entertainment, if you ask me.
Not tasteful, but I'm sure they made a killing.
Oh my God. Not a killing, not the pun.
Oh my God.
You weren't trying to do that on purpose?
I wasn't. That wasn't even on purpose. That makes it so much better.
I'm sure they made a killing off that one.
They made a killing. Oh my God. I can't believe... That's actually perfect. Wow. I'm really proud of myself for that pun.
That was a subconscious pun moment right there.
That was 100... I wish I could take credit and say, no, I definitely thought of that. No, it was subconscious. 100%.
Oh my gosh. And that, my dear weirdos, is the shocking, strange, and sad story of Queen Victoria's wet nurse, Mary Ann, and the murder of her children. I am so sorry. I don't have a happier note to end this on. I was trying to find some like weird, inspirational, uplifting angle, and I was like, you just gotta own it, Steph. You just gotta tell them this is sad.
Yeah, life sucks sometimes, children. So, you know.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
But yeah, that's the story of Marianne Burrow.
Wow, thank you. I, again, no idea that this had happened. Mm-hmm. This is really wild.
It's so strange, and it's one of those cases where I think, as I shared, I think the most likely situation is some form of psychosis. What do you think?
That's what I was thinking too. I think that she just had a break, like she snapped.
Yeah.
And then just did that all. Like you said, I think what you said about a fugue state is 100% precise.
Yeah, because if you snap, but you're very like you're with it, you're in the moment, you're not disassociated, you probably still, I don't know. I just think her confessing immediately and being really insistent on like, no, I did it, like I'm guilty, just like send me away type of thing, makes me think she wasn't fully there when she committed the crimes.
Right. And also all the testimony from her neighbors saying that she was actually like a good mom. She was too nice to her kids.
Yeah, like too sweet, too lenient. I know. It's so sad. But it's still, you know, they just didn't have the forensics to like recreate things in a way where we could have a better understanding. They obviously didn't have the mental health knowledge about what can happen to moms with like the big hormonal changes and everything. So it's wild. It was a wild story.
Yep. Particularly brutal and wild.
Yay.
History for weirdos. That's our new tagline.
Brutal and wild. So before we wrap up, I'm just going to briefly share my sources for this week.
Okay.
There's ranker.com. That's where I found this story the first time. I found this story a really long time ago, and it's been like in an open tab on my phone for forever. And I decided to just finally do it.
Nice.
Thoughtco.com, National Institute of Health, the English Heritage Organization, History Channel, Royal Collection Trust, and Murderpedia.
Oh, very nice. Not Wikipedia, but Murderpedia.
There was no Wikipedia page on this, but there was Murderpedia.
Of course. Yeah, the true crime, like...
community?
Yeah, community. Yeah, I was going to say, like, aficionados, but maybe community's better. Yeah, they go hard with this stuff.
Murderpedia is a really interesting resource.
I consider you, like, a true crime person. Me, not as much, but I definitely think you are.
I think when I reflect on our podcast episodes thus far, I've definitely covered murder the most.
Yeah, you've covered it more than I have, for sure.
Yeah. Shout out to Danielle Starr, if she's listening, our friend who also thinks about murder all the time. And I know she sometimes listens to this podcast. So hi.
Hello.
This one's
there.
For you.
Well, weirdos, that was our week's story. Thank you, Stephanie, for presenting. Again, third time saying this, I had no idea. And I had no idea what this episode was going to be on. And I had never heard of this before. So that was really cool.
I'm glad.
I love story time.
Yes, yes.
I loved it when I was 6, and I love it now at like 31.
How was this a fun story time with a couple drinks in you?
Oh, absolutely. I'm really glad I wasn't sober for this.
Yay, I'm so glad. Well, thank you so much, weirdos. Until next time.
Until next time, weirdos. Adios and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.